This is April and Mackenzie from Atlanta, Georgia, and you are listening to the amazing California Dreaming on the Orbital Jigsaw Network.
This episode of California Dreaming is brought to you by Blueberry. Creating a podcast isn't that simple. It's more than just recording yourself and uploading it. To really get your show to be everything you want it to be, you're going to need a little more than that. You need easy, reliable hosting so your time can be spent creating your content, the most accurate download stats so you know if you're reaching the audience you're wanting to, and a web page that makes setting up totally easy on you and won't take up too much of your valuable time. And Blueberry offers all of this and more for hosts and aspiring hosts alike. Simple media hosting, a fully integrated WordPress website with their PowerPress sites. So if you already have a podcast or you've always dreamed about starting one, head over to www.orbitaljigsaw.com/dream to sign up, and the first month is on us. The Blueberry support team is available to walk you through the steps of migrating your show without losing any subscribers, or to help you get started in the process of launching your new show. With the first month for free, using promo code DREAM, you've got no more excuses. So, let's get started. I would like to take the time to thank everyone for continuing to support California Dreaming on social media by following us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, as well as those who have left reviews for the show on Apple Podcasts or whichever platforms you listen to the show on. By spreading the word, by recommending California Dreaming in listening groups, and of course, supporting us on Patreon as well. There are about 20 exclusive bonuses on Patreon, and for as little as $1 a month, you can gain access to all of those episodes. This week, I would like to thank Kelly G, and I have two Tonys to thank, Tony and Tony at INFP Films. Thank you for joining Patreon, and Emily H. for raising up her pledge to the next tier. If you would like to make a one-time donation to help support, you can do so through PayPal using our email, californiapod@gmail.com. Again, thank you for all of your support. And one last thing before we get into today's show. As I was choosing the voicemail for this episode, I accidentally deleted Lauren's voicemail, Lauren from San Antonio, Texas. So if you could please call in and leave another message, I'd really appreciate it. I'm sorry I'm such a dork. The number is 530-346-4084. And if anyone listening would like to call in, please feel free to leave your message as well, and it will be played in a future episode. Again, the number is 530-346-4084. Dreamers, I have a question for you. Can you think of a crime, any crime, where the perpetrator took a really long time to plan the thing? I looked back at the cases we covered, and I tried to think about some of the ones that took quite some time to plan. Like the ones where the perpetrator left a manifesto. For example, in episode 8, entitled The Tale of the Last Resort, we talked about the killing spree committed by disgruntled ex-cop Christopher Dorner. The amount of time he spent planning his crimes is uncertain, though we do know from his manifesto that it was quite some time in the making. And to refresh your memory, Dorner had been fired from the LAPD in 2008 for making false statements in a grievance report that he filed against a colleague. Dorner subsequently appealed the decision to terminate him from the department, but their decision to fire him was upheld. And because Dorner insisted that he reported what he believed to be the truth, once his termination was upheld, he became enraged at the hearing and screamed at everyone in the room. Dorner filed another appeal in 2011, but the ruling again was affirmed, citing California laws that the findings of the LAPD that Dorner had filed a false report was automatically given the entitlement of the presumption of correctness, and the burden of proving it to be incorrect is on Dorner. And they came to the conclusion that the LAPD had proven their case with an abundance of evidence, and Dorner, they found, levied allegations that were not credible. So after exhausting all of his opportunities to appeal the decision to fire him, with the hopes of being reinstated into his position with the LAPD gone, Dorner decided to retaliate. At the beginning of February 2013, some 5 years after being fired from the LAPD, Dorner published an 11,000-word manifesto on Facebook. And in this manifesto, he named 40 members of law enforcement who he stated he wanted to kill. It said in part, "I know most of you who personally know me are in disbelief to hear from media reports that I am suspected of committing such horrendous murders and have taken drastic and shocking actions in the last couple of days. Unfortunately, this is a necessary evil that I do not enjoy, but must partake and complete for substantial change to occur within the LAPD and reclaim my name. The department has not changed since the Rampart and Rodney King days. It has gotten worse." Christopher Dorner had one demand, that the LAPD admit publicly that his termination was an act of retaliation against him for reporting the use of excessive force. Then Dorner set his plan into motion, a plan 5 years in the making. He sent a package to Anderson Cooper over at CNN that contained, among other things, a DVD with his case against the LAPD. His killing spree began 2 days later on February 3rd when he killed the daughter of a former LAPD captain and her fiancé in Irvine, California. 4 days later, he ambushed two officers sitting in their squad car at a red light, shooting both of them, killing one of them. 5 days after that, Dorner opened fire on two San Bernardino County Sheriff's deputies, again shooting both of them, killing one of them. With his death toll up to 4, cornered in a cabin in the San Bernardino Mountains, Dorner ended up taking his own life with a single gunshot wound to the head, and the cabin he was in burned to the ground. And speaking of manifestos, Mr. Day of Retribution, Elliot Rogers' dizzying 140-page rant about how miserable his life was. Remember that one? I don't know how long it took him to write the thing. And I don't know how many years Roger contemplated the killing spree that he went on. But based on his writings, he had been thinking about it for at least a year, probably even more. He was waiting for the right time, I guess. We discussed the contents of his manifesto across 4 episodes last summer. And from what I understand, it was a thing he wrote in the days leading up to the actual shooting, perhaps 3 or 4 days. I was under the impression he'd been keeping this document over a longer period of time because he had so many details when it came to his entire life story. But it seems to have been something he was feverishly typing as his day of retribution was approaching. But in it, it was clear that Roger had been wanting to harm those who he felt rejected him, namely pretty girls, for a really long time. He had this plan. It was only a matter of it being the right time and place for him to put it into action. His manifesto is impossible to summarize in just a minute or two for purposes of this story. By the time his day of retribution was complete, he took 6 innocent lives before taking his own. Of course, those weren't the only 2 cases we covered where a certain level of planning went into a crime. There were some that we talked about that had a decent amount of prep time, like the North Hollywood shootout or the infamous PTA mom, which is still one of my favorite stories. Some crimes take a few weeks, perhaps even months. Criminals like to try to outsmart law enforcement. So if they want to pull off some big heist, like the North Hollywood shootout or something like that, they'll make all these meticulous plans, but you know they can't plan for everything. Like when those 2 gunmen entered into the Bank of America that day, they could not have anticipated that just as they made their way in through the front doors, a police cruiser would just happen to be driving by right at that exact moment, and noticed two individuals clad head to toe in body armor, which would seriously diminish the amount of time that they thought they had to grab as much money as they could and get out. Or another example of long-term planning would be a case we haven't covered, but it has been featured extensively in a number of podcasts. The Columbine High School massacre, which the 20th anniversary just passed last month. Those two killers, they planned out their crimes extensively. It seemed as though part of the excitement of it all was the planning, anticipating the day. They looked forward to carrying out the murders they committed. And if it weren't for the fact, thank goodness, that they really didn't know what they were doing when they were building their bombs, the body count would have likely been much higher. How long did those two spend planning? Months? A year? Perhaps even more? I heard a story on a podcast a couple of years back now. And the reason it stood out in my mind all this time was because of all the years of planning that went into this crime. Many of you may have heard the story too. The killer's name was Peter Keller. In 2004, in the Cascade Mountains of Washington State, Keller began constructing a bunker. It was this underground structure he began building and filling with supplies so he would be able to live for an extended period of time after he carried out his plan, a plan to murder his wife and 18-year-old daughter, which he did carry out in 2012. He also attempted to burn down their house before he fled to his hideaway, but the house didn't burn down. And when investigators were finally able to sift through the home, they came across Keller's computer hard drive, and on it, they found at least one picture of the bunker he had been constructing somewhere in the Cascades. Investigators were able to enhance the picture, and from there, experts were able to come up with an estimation of where the bunker likely was located. Interviews with witnesses were also able to place Keller's truck having been frequently parked at the Rattlesnake Trailhead, so that would be their starting point. As the ground search for Keller commenced, they began seeing what looked like fresh tracks made by military-style boots, and these were leading to places in the foothills of the mountains that nobody would be hiking at. It was way too steep. There were no defined hiking trails, and it was so treacherous that the footing was totally unstable. So of course, for a man who had done all this meticulous planning, he wasn't going to make it easy for anyone to find him. Once investigators were able to pinpoint the location where they believed the clandestine bunker to be, they waited for daybreak the next day to send in the SWAT team. Dozens of officers at first light began crawling all over the mountainside, all of them dressed in full camouflage, faces painted, and they moved slowly and as quietly as possible, looking for where Keller's hideout was located. Finally, the smell of a wood stove wafted by before they were even able to see where the smell was coming from. This is where Keller was. Law enforcement requested that the media stay very quiet about the developments in the story, as they were certain Keller was in his bunker monitoring the media and the radio waves as well. They were very careful to make sure that he didn't know that they were closing in, as he could very easily ambush them. To try and force Keller out, the SWAT team fired tear gas in, but it didn't work. Keller did not emerge. So what they needed to do was figure out what was going on inside this bunker without putting anyone's lives in jeopardy. It would eventually be revealed that the bunker had 2.5 levels. He had spent all those years digging and excavating a kind of horseshoe-shaped crevice, even having to make his way through layers of bedrock. So you know he put a great deal of time and effort into doing this, and he was doing it by himself. He chopped down trees, Cut them in half lengthwise and use those pieces to create the walls of the interior of the bunker, sort of like a log cabin. The lower level was about as wide as the average person's arms could stretch out lengthwise. And this is where he'd neatly stored bottled water and sodas on shelves that he built. Also on this level, he kept a large bin of beans and barley and candy. There was also a generator and PVC pipe that was used to bring in water. He had Ziploc bags full of other supplies, including ammunition. He also had improvised explosive devices, a stockpile of high-powered rifles, and a bulletproof vest. Sometime during the night, the SWAT officers that were there for the night shift heard a single pop sound coming from the bunker. They weren't certain, but they began to think that might have been Keller, and he might be dead. The next step was to use explosives to compromise the interior of the structure just enough to loosen the logs he had in place without completely collapsing it. They were still worried about the potential of being ambushed by Keller or by booby traps, so they sent in a camera that wound its way through the bunker. And that's when they saw on their monitors that Keller was dead. So the explosives experts went ahead and exploded the top off the bunker. They began pulling the logs away to expose the interior from the outside. Keller had shot himself on the very top level of his bunker, and his body fell down to the bottom. This has always been one of those extraordinary stories that has stood out in my mind because of all the years Keller put into building this bunker. He's described in articles written about him as a survivalist, but I would use that term very loosely, to be honest, in describing him, and I'll explain why in a moment. Keller documented at least part of his activities on a digital recorder and explained his reasons for this plan to kill his 41-year-old wife, Lynette, and 18-year-old daughter, Kayleen. He called it the end. In his video, he said, "It's just going to be a point of, you know, going as far as I can. I do have my escape, and that's death. Can always shoot myself, and I'm okay with that. I'm just getting to the point where just trying to live and pay bills and live as a civilian, to go to work, it just freaks me out. It's actually more comfortable for me to think about living out here, robbing banks, pharmacies, just taking what I want for as long as I can. At least it will be exciting." And this is where I take issue with the word survivalist in describing Keller. I mean, okay, I get it. He's out in the woods someplace in Washington State. But the robbing of banks and pharmacies? That means he needs money to buy himself supplies. You know, food, water, whatever. And he knows he's probably going to get sick, so he's going to need meds to get through. That's not exactly what I would define as being a quote-unquote survivalist. I mean, far be it from me to judge. I'm a city person. I would have a hard time surviving being locked out of my house. But Keller's relying on money and pharmaceuticals to survive, and that sounds like being a civilian. The thing he said that freaks him out. My opinion, he didn't want to do the family man thing anymore. He knew killing his wife and daughter, he couldn't stick around, so this was his half-assed way of going off the grid. But not really, because he planned on going back on the grid as a bank robber or whatever to fund his so-called survivalist lifestyle. As it would later be revealed, Keller had sketches of the bunker he intended to build dating back to 2003. So we know that he began planning this for nearly a decade. That means he started thinking about this when his daughter was only 8 or maybe 9 years old. She had barely even made it into the 3rd, maybe 4th grade when he decided he didn't want to be a dad anymore. And even more sad, she continued to be raised by this man all through middle school and into high school. He saw her all the way through to graduation. I saw pictures of the three of them on her graduation day. It feels like some sort of sick joke on his part. The deceit and all the pretending all those years before he decided to murder her and her mother on April 22nd, 2012. My apologies for going on so long about this, but it just blows my mind to think about all the time these killers spent planning, because the fact is, many of the cases we've discussed on the show really had minimal planning. I mean, the amount of time it takes to decide to murder someone varies from case to case, and some of them had very little planning involved. But if there had been even a few seconds or half a minute of contemplation between the time someone decides to kill someone to the time that they actually do it, those split seconds of deliberation often make the difference between first degree and second degree murder. It only takes a few seconds before it can be defined as something planned. But in the cases I've discussed thus far, the list of 40 individuals targeted for murder, the 141-page manifesto, the 8-year-long construction of a bunker, it's mind-boggling to think about these killers sitting there day in and day out for years on end planning. They're going to work or they're going to school. They're living their lives. All the while, when nobody is watching, they're contemplating these diabolical plans. And as they're doing so, their frustration and rage continue to fester just beneath the surface. And we're going to look into a case today that was a plan born out of an unrequited love. A plan 2 decades in the making. In today's 90th episode of California Dreaming, the tale of a deadly obsession. Dreamers, I'm going to start off by telling you the story of a man named Ralph Marcus. You're going to come to find that he's the kind of guy who fits the description of a ne'er-do-well. And just to see how ne'er-do-well is spelled, I looked it up because it's a word I've so rarely written down before. I may have called Nuzio Bagarin in episodes 87 and 88 a ne'er-do-well, but I didn't bother to see if I spelled it correctly in my notes, mainly because nobody's going to be seeing my notes. But this time, out of curiosity, I checked. And I looked at the various definitions and synonyms as well. A bum, a derelict, a do-nothing, no good, slacker, worthless person, unsuccessful, a person who is ineffectual, completely lacking merit, and my favorite one from Wikipedia, a good-for-nothing louse. All of these adjectives would more than aptly apply here when discussing Ralph Marcus. Marcus, in addition to being a ne'er-do-well, he strikes me as being sort of a sniveling little man. And on top of that, he's another guy who would never really work an honest day in his life. He's a con artist, and he never worked alone. He always had someone with him, a partner or an associate who participated in his underhanded schemes. Together, Marcus and whomever he was working with committed serial insurance fraud. They set fires, they faked stolen vehicles, they faked burglaries, and they staged auto accidents in order to falsify property damage. And when Marcus would be caught and prosecuted, which I don't know how many times over the years he was convicted of insurance fraud, it would be demonstrated over and over again that he consistently had little to no viable means of income, though he would claim he made a living gambling, which we know, hearkening back to episode 82, the tale of the pro poker player, we know how well that can go. And so most of the time in dealing with Ralph Marcus, prosecutors would strike deals with whomever he paired up with for each scam and offered them immunity from prosecution in exchange for their testimony. So it would lead us to believe that Marcus was most likely the mastermind of each of these insurance fraud scams. And based on what I know of the case that we are discussing today, Marcus most likely targeted younger, more impressionable individuals to recruit each of them for his schemes. He'd be in charge, he'd do all the planning, and he would take the bigger percentage of the take for himself. So it wouldn't be difficult for Marcus's co-conspirators to be so quickly and easily convinced to testify against him in order to avoid prosecution because they were likely younger, more inexperienced, gullible, and probably convinced by Marcus that these were essentially victimless crimes, since the money would be coming from big insurance companies anyway. So all of this is meant to demonstrate that Ralph Marcus is a good-for-nothing louse. So now I want to tell you about a young man named Nicholas Howard. We'll call him Nick. At the time our story takes place, he was only 18 years old, just out of high school. He was still living with his parents, and I didn't get the impression that things were all that difficult for him based on an interview I watched with his mother, Patty. But it did seem that Nick lacked a bit when it came to ambition or future goals. He didn't really have any idea yet what he was going to do with his life. So he took to working with his father, who worked as a mechanic at a shop that he owned. His mom said that they had an understanding that Nick was welcome to stay living at home for as long as he wanted or needed, as long as he was either attending college or working steadily, as she recognized the absence of motivation or drive to get going into adulthood. So Nick chose to work. And during the day, Nick would be at the shop with his dad. But he was definitely described as being more of a night person, and he liked going out and staying out late, hanging out with his friends, and doing whatever it was he and his friends were up to. And on February 4th, 1997, it was no different. Except for the fact that Nick had forgotten his driver's license at the restaurant he had been at earlier in the evening. How it was he left his license behind, it's not clear. But when he went back to the restaurant later on that evening to retrieve it, the place had already closed for the night. So Nick left a note on the door to let the owner know he had come by. When his mom, Patty, got a look at the note later on, she confirmed that the handwriting was indeed that of her son. So they knew that he had gone by there at some point late into the evening. A little while later, Nick called his house, but his parents didn't answer. They had already gone to bed. The answering machine picked up and Nick left a voicemail. His message said, "I'm on my way home. I had a little bit of car trouble, and so I'll be home in about a half hour or so. I'm wiped out." But when his mom got up the following morning to check on her son, she found that he had never made it home the night before. And to her, this was out of character for him. No matter how late he stayed out, he always eventually made his way home. So Patty grew concerned right away and contacted police to report Nick missing. And unlike so many cases with missing young men, and remember this was 22 years ago, back in 1997, it seemed like the local law enforcement took the missing persons report seriously, so good on them for a change. They began by taking a look at the area around the restaurant where Nick had left that note the previous evening, as that was the last known place that he was to have gone. And it seemed as though the restaurant was situated on a stretch of road that ran alongside the Sacramento River, and portions of this road were somewhat rough to navigate. This took place in Yolo County, and I looked on Google Earth to try and get an idea of what the area looked like. And from what I could see, there is maybe a highway or a freeway on one side of the river and a road on the other side. While I can't be sure which section of road we're discussing, it all looks like it can be a challenge to drive, especially at night when it's dark and for a young driver with only maybe a couple years experience under his belt, if that. If you aren't paying attention, or if Nick was tired like he said he was in his voicemail, it is possible that he drifted off and could have gone into the river. and in the area near the restaurant, the road was narrow along the water, so it was very possible for something like that to have happened. And so a search of the water began, volunteers and law enforcement alike. And 2 days after Nick was reported missing, his car was actually found submerged in the Sacramento River, 18 feet or 5.5 meters down. When the car was pulled from the water and examined by a mechanic, it was determined that when his vehicle entered the water, the engine was running. And the way they were able to come to this conclusion is because when they looked at the vehicle's radiator, there was some sort of contact marks caused by the fan belt grinding away at some portions of it, and this could have only been caused with a running engine going into water. But the strange thing was, Nick's body was nowhere to be found. Whenever there's been an accident where a car is driven off the road, almost always the body or bodies of the victims remain inside. If they are able to get out of the vehicle, they either swim to safety or they drown and turn up downstream, not long after the discovery of the accident. Though it is possible for a deceased victim to be separated from their vehicle when driven into a body of water, it is not typical. So the fact that they didn't find Nick inside the car was surprising. They did, however, find Nick's glasses on the floorboard of the car, and it looked as though they had been broken or bent, perhaps when he impacted with the water. He possibly hit his head or his face into the steering wheel, causing his glasses to break and fall off his face. So, even though the outlook was grim, there was still a glimmer of hope that Nick made it out of the car and was able to swim to safety. But because of the possibility of a head injury, he was unable to figure out where he was, or what happened, or perhaps he was so discombobulated that he was unable to remember who he was. So with that in mind, Nick's family kept their hopes up that he would turn up in a hospital somewhere. But something didn't sit right with investigators. From the initial examination of the scene, from the way it looked as though Nick's car had gone into the water, coupled with the theory that he made his way out of the vehicle or his body was separated from the vehicle, it didn't really make a whole lot of sense. And we will come back to this and Nick's glasses in a little bit. There was one thing investigators did find inside the car that they found to be quite perplexing. The interior of the car, the dashboard, the inside of the windows, and all of the upholstery, everything was covered in a thin, greasy film. It appeared to be sort of a whitish substance, kind of milky in consistency. And at first, they had no idea what it was covering the inside of the car. As they began taking a closer look at the substance and upon closer examination, once they were able to touch it and smell it, they came to realize it was actually motor oil. Strange for the inside of the car to be completely covered in oil. I mean, how is it that oil would possibly seep inside the passenger compartment, presumably having come from the engine compartment, right? In the accident, maybe the oil cap in the engine was jarred loose. Maybe it wasn't tightened properly. Perhaps some other path through which oil circulates through the engine was damaged or broken in the crash, causing oil to leak out. But even so, wouldn't the oil have just spilled directly into the water as opposed to into the passenger compartment? Well, the answer is this. When investigators took a look in the trunk of Nick's car, they discovered the source of the oily film. There was an empty quart of motor oil in the trunk, and it appeared as though the oil spilled out of it while the car was in the water, and it seeped from the trunk into the passenger compartment. Okay, that's fine. Now we know how the oil got all over the inside of the car, but that leaves us asking another question. Why the heck is this bottle of oil in the trunk without its cap? This wasn't a case of the cap being loose and it was jarred open as a result of the accident, being tossed around the trunk and submerged in the water. The cap was completely missing. Nowhere in the trunk or anywhere else where it was immediately obvious. So why? I mean, motor oil is like the worst. When it gets on stuff or onto your driveway, even when you spill a little bit of it when you're trying to put oil into your engine, even when you're just checking your oil levels, it's messy. It's hard to get oil stains out of anything, and it has a strong odor. And I have a little side story here about oil. Just recently, a couple weeks back, my daughter had borrowed her grandma's car. For whatever reason, I can't remember why. And when she got home later, she mentioned to me that the inside of her car smelled like gasoline. And my mom is one of those annoying people at the gas station who sits there forever topping off her gas tank as much as possible, sometimes to the point where it spills out onto the car and onto the ground, right? She does it all the time, and it's so irritating because sometimes it makes the inside of the car smell like gas, especially if she gets it on her shoes or something like that. And it lasts for a while, so you have to drive around with the strong odor of gas emanating from the car, which is like, whatever, if she wants to blow herself up, that's her problem. So I told my daughter her crazy grandma probably topped off the gas way too much. But then, a few days later, we stopped by my mom's house for some reason, and I noticed all this oil all over her front bumper and all over the driveway. So we opened the hood, and somehow the oil cap had not only come loose, but it was completely off and resting upside down where it should have been screwed in. How her oil cap ended up like that, I have absolutely no idea. But it was a horrible mess, and the smell was so strong. And I bet while my daughter was driving it like that, it was really terrible burning off as it spewed out of the hot engine. Well, my point is, oil is awfully messy. And for this oil bottle to have been discovered in Nick's car without its cap should have raised some eyebrows right away for investigators. Whether or not they thought much of it when they first discovered the source of the oil, I'm not sure. But we're going to put that motor oil and its missing cap on the back burner for right now, because we will come back to that as well. At first glance, it looked as though Nick could have possibly fallen asleep while he was driving and drifted off the road and ended up in the water. It seemed like the simple answer. But investigators have experienced crash scenes like this, where someone has fallen asleep and all of a sudden they become jolted awake as soon as the car starts going off the road and into the shrubs or rough terrain before going into the water. And when this happens, there are indicators that the driver quickly and dramatically made an attempt to correct the situation, usually by way of sharply turning the steering wheel or applying the brakes. And when this happens, a very distinct path the car would have taken becomes apparent down the embankment. It is something experienced investigators have seen and recognized as the driver's effort to prevent the car from traveling off the road and into water. But this pattern was not seen at the site where Nick's vehicle went into the water. It looked as though Nick's vehicle drove straight and smooth down the embankment, which had investigators wondering, if Nick had dozed off at the wheel, how deep of a sleep could he have been in if going down an uneven, bumpy path of bushes and rocks for the rough ride to not have jerked him awake? Could he have been that deeply asleep? I don't know. I've dozed off in a car, and even when the car comes to a stop or goes into park, I'm usually aware of it. I really can't say I've ever been that deeply asleep in a moving vehicle. But then there are those who can sleep through almost anything, anywhere, so who knows? It depends on the person, but for investigators, a correction effort is almost always a component of the scene whenever they've had a situation where a driver has dozed off and their car veered off the road. Even so, whether Nick dozed off or not, there was still the question as to where was Nick's body. Investigators were already really suspicious of this crash, as it were. And when they looked more closely at the car itself, there was even more troubling signs that this whole thing may not have been an accident at all. In addition to the other findings, it was also discovered that Nick's car, which was a manual transmission, was in neutral. Now, it's been about 20 years since I've driven a manual transmission vehicle, but let's think about this for a moment. If Nick's car is going down the embankment in neutral, this must mean his car is drifting with no more acceleration once the car was shifted into neutral. Could the car have slipped out of gear at some point as it traveled down its path into the water? Maybe. I can't recall off the top of my head if it was possible to shift out of gear into neutral without applying the clutch. I think you can go into neutral without applying the clutch, but it's been so long. I'm pretty sure you can't go from neutral into gear without pressing the clutch. But whatever the case, the car was in neutral. So if Nick was driving and his car went into the water, would his car's gear shift be in the neutral position? Likely it wouldn't be. Especially if he was driving, his car would have had to have been in gear. And then, what if Nick was in the car and he fell asleep and he was jolted awake by suddenly finding himself going off the road and he immediately went into correcting himself? Could he have been the one to shift the car into neutral at that point? Well, if the engine was running and he suddenly slammed on the brakes, if the car was in gear, wouldn't the car have stalled out? It's possible that the driver may have slipped the transmission into neutral, but not likely. But once investigators opened the hood of the car and had a chance to closely examine the engine, they would notice something peculiar that would answer several of the puzzling questions that had been raised thus far into the investigation. When they looked under the hood of the vehicle, they discovered the missing cap that belonged to the motor oil bottle. It had a V on it, which stood for Valvoline, and it was a match to the brand of oil found in the trunk. But it wasn't just floating around in the engine compartment. It didn't magically make its way from the trunk into the engine, you know, because that would have been impossible. The oil cap was placed there on purpose. They found it wedged into the carburetor, holding open the throttle. And this was the thing that the experts examining the car, the mechanics and whatnot, they had never seen this before, the throttle being rigged. What this meant to investigators was that the oil cap holding open the throttle would have been able to essentially mimic the situation in which someone was seated in the car pressing down on the accelerator. And this would mean the car could be operated essentially without a driver. Because, as I said earlier, this was a thing that investigators had not previously seen, they did some tests to find out what the bottle cap would have caused the car to do. They used an identical oil cap in the carburetor of a different car, and they jammed open the throttle. But for their testing purposes, they would have someone seated in the driver's seat in order to maintain control of the car once the testing was finished, and they would be able to bring the vehicle to a stop. When the car was started, with the vehicle's throttle kept open by that oil cap, the vehicle began moving on its own and accelerating, the engine firing, and the gas would begin to take over, giving the car its power to move, all the while gradually gaining speed. This meant Nick's car could have been sent into the river without anybody seated in the driver's seat. From a thorough examination of the scene, based on where Nick's car ultimately ended up in the water, accident reconstructionists determined that the vehicle was traveling approximately 25 miles or a little more than 40 kilometers per hour when it went off the road. And by the time it started down the embankment, the terrain caused the vehicle to slow down to approximately 15 miles or a little more than 24 kilometers per hour by the time it entered into the water. So the vehicle was not moving very fast. not at the speed someone might be driving while traveling along the road adjacent to the river. And this brings us back to Nick's glasses. Remember I mentioned earlier that they were found on the floorboard of the vehicle bent and broken. But the manner in which they were bent, this too did not sit well with investigators. They seemed a little too bent. And now that they knew how fast the car was traveling when it hit the water, it made them question the possibility of the glasses being as damaged as they were. So accident reconstructionists worked to recreate the accident using a model head they fashioned out of styrofoam and weighed it down to make it approximately the same weight as Nick's head. The model head was set up for testing and a pair of glasses identical to Nick's were placed on the styrofoam. In order to simulate the force of the impact, the head was attached to a pendulum and it was raised up to a level that was calculated using the potential energy formula, mass times gravity times height, to raise the head up and release it, allowing it to swing into an affixed steering wheel. The test was videotaped, and it recorded what would have happened if Nick's head hit the steering wheel if the car had been traveling at 15 miles or 24 kilometers per hour. The results of the test revealed that the glasses in the simulated crash scenario resulted in far less damage than Nick's actual glasses that were found inside his vehicle had sustained. I will try to remember to post pictures of the actual glasses so you can get an idea of how damaged they were and how obviously overbent they were in a way that was not indicative of a crash at the speeds his car was said to have been traveling. So what does this mean? Well, it meant Nick's head did not come in contact with the steering wheel that caused that damage to his glasses. And Nick certainly wouldn't have purposely bent his glasses in the way that they were found. I mean, why in the world would he do that, right? What this meant was Nick's glasses were planted. And once this had been determined, it had investigators thinking and Nick's family holding on to the hope that Nick wasn't in the car when it crashed and that he could still be alive. No doubt filled with anxiety and worry as they waited for him to turn up, however. It would take about 3 weeks for Nick's family to finally get the answers as to what happened to him. The search for Nick had been extensive, but a dive crew searching the waters of the Sacramento River finally recovered Nick's body 3 weeks after he was last seen, about a quarter mile or half a kilometer downriver from where his car went in. His body had remained underwater during that time until he finally surfaced and was found. Patty received the news that Nick was dead and it devastated her. And they weren't telling her right away how he died. She described finding out by saying, "One minute you're a mom to your son, and then you don't have him anymore." His sister Jamie called him her best friend, not only to her, but to everyone who was his friend, could describe him as their best friend as well. That's just the way that he was, very close to the people that he cared about. He was a very laid-back kind of a guy, just a really cool kid. And even though he may have been at a crossroads in life after he got out of high school, he still had so much life to look forward to. A promising future that would never be realized. He never got the chance to choose his path because his life was cut so tragically short at the age of 18. When Nick's body was examined, it was noted pretty quickly that he did not have any oil on his body. Even though he had been submerged in water, if he had been inside his car when it went into the water, with that open bottle of motor oil spilling in the trunk, seeping into the passenger compartment, completely covering the interior of the car with that greasy, milky film, logic would dictate that Nick would have been covered in oil as well. But he wasn't. Even being submerged in water for 3 weeks still would not have washed away motor oil from his body or his clothing. We talked about what a mess oil is. That stuff would have persisted despite the water. And what this did was solidify the theory that Nick was not inside his car when it went into the water. Nick's autopsy also revealed that he had suffered a severe beating. And seeing as it's been shown that he was not in his car when it crashed, he was not involved in any kind of accident. And the types of injuries he sustained would not have been caused by anything during the time that he was in the water. And what this meant was somebody made him that way. The pathologist found Nick had suffered internal injuries. And what specifically was found was bleeding within Nick's neck muscles, also known as strap muscle hemorrhaging. This is a telltale sign that Nick had been manually strangled. He had bruises about the head and face, as well as blunt force injuries to various parts of his body, evidence of a severe beating. And the pathologist, in examining Nick's lungs, found there to be water inside them, which told the medical examiner that when Nick was thrown into the water, he was still breathing. The strangulation, the beating, none of that killed Nick. His cause of death was deprivation of oxygen. Nick likely went into the water unconscious, and ultimately, he died as a result of a lack of oxygen due to drowning. His manner of death was ruled a homicide. Their missing persons investigation had just turned into a murder investigation. Now that investigators had discovered that Nick and his car went into the Sacramento River separately, they wanted to know who sent his car down the embankment and who tossed Nick in. The first thing detectives asked themselves was this question: who stood to benefit the most from Nick Howard's death? They soon uncovered the fact that Nick actually had several substantial life insurance policies that had been obtained the previous April of 1996. One of the life insurance policies had an accidental death benefit rider stipulated, bringing the insurance policy worth a total of $850,000 in the event Nick died in an accident. It is very, very unusual for someone Nick's age, only 18 years old at the time, to have a life insurance policy worth that much money. And it should be noted that the policy was purchased about 1 month after Nick turned 18. Nick's family apparently were aware of the life insurance policies, though whether or not they were involved in the process of obtaining them is unknown. But they were under the impression that they were the beneficiaries listed in his policies. But the investigation soon revealed that his family were not the beneficiaries. When Patty found out this information, she went into Nick's room to look for the paperwork related to his life insurance policies. She found the documents, the one that had indicated that they were the beneficiaries, but along with the papers, there was one loose page sort of sticking out. When Patty pulled on it, she found it to be an application for a change of beneficiary. This particular piece of paper was a carbonless paper copy, and it appeared that it had been crumpled up because the creases in the paper, when it was crumpled, left an impression on the carbonless page. The application had also been folded once, and it also listed the name of the new beneficiary, none other than Ralph Marcus, serial insurance fraudster. Patty was very surprised to see Marcus's name on the policy as the new beneficiary. She knew who Ralph Marcus was. She had actually known him for quite some time. They had gone way back before Nick was even born. I told you a little bit about Ralph Marcus at the beginning of the story. And by this time, The time of Nick's death, Marcus was 37 years old. And based on what I mentioned earlier about his criminal history, he was still a loser with no real job to speak of or means of income or support. When looking into his background, once his name came up on that policy, investigators uncovered his criminal past, along with what, if anything, he was into in more recent times. They found that he did have a gambling habit. He apparently attempted to maintain kind of an ostentatious lifestyle, but he really couldn't keep a job for very long. Anytime he ever tried to work legitimately, it quickly came to an end for one reason or another. For Patty, her experiences with Ralph Marcus dated back to when the two of them were in high school. She described him as a creep. He was just always there. In her words, he never went away. He wasn't constantly around, but he was around enough to be pestering her and eventually pestering her family. The relationship between the Howards and Marcus was very tense. The first time Patty met Marcus, it was more than 20 years earlier, as I said, in high school. She described their first encounter as having taken place inside her house. What he was doing over there, I don't know if it was a friendly visit or if he invited himself over, though I didn't get the impression from the way that she described it that he was over there with the intentions of this being a date of any kind. He had come over, and he had only been in her home for less than 10 minutes when he made an unwanted sexual advance towards Patty. She said he sort of wrestled her to the ground and tried kissing her. She resisted his advances and pushed him away, as these were not her intentions. She didn't even know who this guy was. As time passed and years went by, Ralph Marcus never really gave up trying to become romantically involved with Patty. He regularly made advances towards her, even asking her on a number of occasions to marry him, and each time she said no. Patty went on to marry someone else, her husband, Nick's dad, and they had two children together, and she did what she could to maintain a comfortable distance from Marcus. But he was relentless in his pursuit of Patty, to a point where it had long crossed over into a full-blown obsession. Then one day, Marcus came to her with a proposition. It was his desire to have a child with Patty, and he asked if he could pay her for her eggs. He offered $50,000, and his plan would be to hire a surrogate mother to carry their biological child. Of course, she again said no, absolutely not. And just as he was about to leave, Marcus placed his hand on Patty and told her that he would love for her to be the one to carry their child, but he realized that it was not a possibility. This attempt to purchase Patty's eggs with a desire to have a surrogate mother carry their child was simply too much. Marcus had crossed the line with this request, and Patty had to put an end to this. Marcus had already been a thorn in the side of Patty's husband, but this was way too much. It was hurting him, and ultimately it was hurting their relationship. And she simply didn't want to put him or their family through this anymore. At that point, she decided there could no longer be any kind of friendship or relationship with Ralph Marcus any longer. This had gone on for far too many years now. And I know many of us listening, if there was someone pestering our significant other, someone who was just always in the periphery, we wouldn't like it either. But there was one thing Patty and her husband could not stop, even though they tried. They could not get Nick to steer clear of Ralph Marcus. Marcus would go around telling Nick that he was his godfather. And Marcus went through a great deal of effort to win Nick's friendship and his affections. He did things to try to impress Nick, to get him to look up to him. This was his roundabout way of getting to the object of his affections, Patty. Nick's mom. Nick was his vehicle. Nick was his connection. The only connection he was able to make and hang on to long after Patty had told him to buzz off. And Nick, he was young and impressionable. And Marcus is a cunning con man. He was a fast talker, a liar, a schemer. And he was into fun stuff that impressed Nick. Gambling, a fun, flashy lifestyle in the fast lane. Nick's mom felt as though Ralph Marcus made a concerted effort to become friends with Nick in order to continue having a place in their family's life. After the surrogate mother request, she made it clear that she was no longer interested in having anything to do with him and to just stay away. So the only way to continue lingering in their lives was to befriend Nick. And it worked. Patty also thinks that a part of it was to find out information about her from Nick. He would ask questions just to be nosy about her personal life. And he did so through his friendship with her son. And in an interesting side note to all of this, as I was researching this case, I was reminded of a similar situation my husband David. I call him my husband in all of these episodes, and some of you might know from the Facebook group or whatever, though he's not all that much into social media, like very much at all. But for just future reference, his name is David. He was in a similar, though not exactly the same situation with a man his mom had dated briefly. Even though the relationship between his mom and this man never really went anywhere and kind of flickered out, this man continued having contact with David. And they kind of had a friendship for a while. He was living in Vegas at the time, so this guy would invite him to go to some of the local casinos. Oh, I mean, all the casinos are local, but what I mean is the casinos that are meant for locals, not the touristy ones on the strip. They'd go to sports books, do some gambling, eat at the buffets. The guy, it seemed, was a pretty avid gambler, so he had all the comps. And if I remember correctly, I want to say that he worked at an art gallery in Caesar's Palace. Anyway, I just remember both my mother-in-law and myself were kind of scratching our heads at this unlikely friendship. I mean, the guy was more than 30 years older than David, who was in his early 20s at the time. And it was just weird. And he was a weird guy. He lived with his mom. He didn't ever have a cell phone. And he raised his nephew for some reason, but did not have kids of his own. He never got married. He was just sort of a strange person. Eventually, I mean, with no cell phone, you're just going to lose touch with people. Eventually, David stopped hanging out with him. I don't know what exactly his angle was. Maybe it was similar to what was going on in the story we're talking about here today, but it just kind of reminded me of that. Though nothing bad or tragic ever occurred. Nothing like this. Anyway, back to this story. Now that Nick was dead and all this information was coming out about Ralph Marcus, Patty started thinking that it was his plan all along to someday do something to cause Nick harm. When it was he decided that was going to be his plan, she can't be sure. Could her having severed their relationship have been the point where Marcus decided he was going to somehow seek retribution for her dismissing him in that manner? Whatever the case, the fact remained that Ralph Marcus had been carrying a torch for Patty for the better part of 2 decades. His plans to be in her life, to try and woo her or court her, or to just be an element in her existence in some way, shape, or form, whatever he was doing, it likely evolved over time. Had he possibly been planning to do her children harm from the time that they were born? Only he knows the answer to that, and I wouldn't put it past him. It might not have been a plan as extreme as murder, at least not in the beginning, but I wouldn't doubt that as soon as Patty gave birth to Nick, Marcus knew someday that he was going to be the way in which he would be able to get closer and stay closer to Patty, through Nick. And he spent a great deal of time and effort grooming him just for the things to go the way he'd planned them to go. He befriended Nick. Even though his mom and dad were telling him to stay away, he wasn't going to listen because Ralph Marcus was that conniving. He took advantage of Nick's youthfulness and his trust. Marcus would invite Nick along for trips. He would take him to do fun things that he may not have otherwise have experienced, at least not at that point in his life. They took trips to Reno and Lake Tahoe, of course both gambling towns. He had Nick convinced that he was some sort of high-stakes gambler. Marcus would reserve nice hotel rooms for them, and they would have women come by. Who were these women? I have no idea, but if I had to guess, I'd say most likely they were paid for or hired by Ralph Marcus. So Ralph Marcus was brought in for questioning, but he denied knowing anything about Nick's murder, and he provided investigators with an alibi for the night Nick went missing and was presumably killed. He claimed he was at home with his mom. He was living with his mom, but she was in her last stages of life. He had his mother, in very poor health, come down and make a statement to police that he was with her the night of Nick's death. They went and searched his home anyway. They served a search warrant, and as soon as police entered his bedroom, they noticed that he had all of Nick's life insurance paperwork lined up across his desk. He had obviously been looking over the paperwork, getting things in order, and it included the change of beneficiary paperwork. Presumably, Ralph Marcus was getting ready to collect on Nick's supposed accidental death. All of these documents were taken into evidence. They wanted to see if the paperwork was in fact completed by Nick, if the writing and the signature was his and not forgeries. And it was determined that everything was legitimately filled out by Nick himself. Everything that was supposed to have been in Nick's handwriting was, including his signature. So that has us asking, why in the world would Nick Howard sign his life insurance policies over to Ralph Marcus instead of his own family? You listening probably know the answer. We know a recurring theme in Marcus's life is insurance fraud scams, and he went about it by recruiting other people to go along with him. Remember when I said he likely picked impressionable young people to talk into being into these schemes, the type likely to fall for a smooth-talking con man like Marcus? Yeah. Nick was yet another pawn used by Marcus in yet another insurance scam. But Nick was more than that to Ralph Marcus. He was also a way of staying close to Patty. For 20 years, over and over, time and time again, Patty rebuffed Marcus's romantic advances. She wasn't stringing him along. She never gave him the impression that there was ever going to be a chance for him to be with her, but he just persisted. He wouldn't or couldn't let go. He was a man obsessed. And so, with that, I ask, how much rejection can one person take before they decide they've had enough? When does Ralph Marcus reach the point where he's been hurt enough and that it was high time, it was his turn to do some of the hurting? That can only be speculated on. And there's also the question as to whether or not Nick was in on the insurance scam with Marcus. Most likely he was, since he willingly signed those change of beneficiary papers. I could easily believe Marcus approached Nick with the scheme to defraud the insurance companies that carried his policy. Remember, Nick was 18 years old and he was just out of high school, and even his mom described him as being more or less directionless at that point in his life. And here comes Ralph Marcus, this cool older guy who likes to gamble and party and have a whole bunch of fun, all of that with a minimal amount of work. So he approaches Nick. He has this idea to defraud the life insurance company. They come up with a plan to fake Nick's death. Marcus will collect on that policy with the accidental death rider. They can both take the money and run off wherever they want to live the easy life. They can kick back, drink cocktails on a beach in some place, parts unknown. They can do whatever they want, gamble whenever they want, and just leave this humdrum life behind. It probably sounded really good to Nick. But all of this is only speculation, dreamers, of course, based on Marcus's past patterns of behaviors. Investigators really had no proof other than their own conjecture that Nick and Marcus were working together to commit insurance fraud. They also didn't have any real proof that it was Ralph Marcus who was the one who beat and strangled Nick and threw him into the Sacramento River. The only thing they really had was the fact that Marcus was the one who stood to gain the $850,000 in the event of Nick's accidental death. And that is only circumstantial evidence. They needed to keep digging. In talking to Nick's sister, Jamie, she recalled a conversation that she had had with Nick not too long before his death. He told her that he was going to change the beneficiary of his life insurance policy. She at first didn't think too much of it. She really didn't take what he was saying all that seriously. When he told her it was his intentions to make Ralph Marcus the new beneficiary, it was then she expressed her concern, telling him, no, not Ralph Marcus. Don't do that. But Nick was like, why not? He could take $850,000 and turn it into $4 million. They would never have to work another day in their lives. So that right there, if Jamie was recalling the conversation accurately, and it does very much sound like something Marcus would say, I could turn $850,000 into $4 million, then yeah, Nick was aware of the insurance fraud scheme. And he was in on it. And this might explain why Nick seemed to be lacking any sort of direction that he wanted to go in life once he was out of high school. He probably had this plan to run away with millions of dollars, so he just decided to not really define his long-term goals, because his long-term goals was a thing he could not share with his parents. Investigators were quickly finding out the shady things that Ralph Marcus was about that I had mentioned in the beginning. He was a man who they described as having decided very early on in life that working for a living was for fools, and his means of supporting himself involved two things: insurance fraud and gambling. But I would also add to that being a louse. They discovered that Marcus had once burned down his own house and collected on the insurance on that. He also staged the theft of one of his cars and a boat, collecting on the insurance on those items as well. So they were pretty convinced that Marcus had decided to take his insurance fraud activities to the next level. This time, instead of houses, cars, or boats, the biggest payout was going to be a life. The death of a life. And he needed to find someone gullible enough to go along with it, who would be willing to fake his own death and walk away from his family forever. Which is really sad and hurtful when you think about it, isn't it? I mean, Nick was going to go and live off of his insurance payout and the gambling winnings with Marcus. But this would have to mean he would never see or contact his family again. Anyway, the investigation was not yielding any physical or forensic evidence linking Marcus to the crime or to the scene of the crime. There were no fibers, no DNA, no fingerprints, no blood, nothing in or on the car or on Nick's body. And investigators were reaching a point where there was soon going to be nowhere else to look. One of the very last ideas they had was to maybe try and link Marcus to the motor oil found in the trunk. It was pretty much their last hope. If they weren't going to be able to link him to anything at the crime scene, the chances of the district attorney filing charges on Ralph Marcus were slim. They were going to need more than just guesswork and theories, especially for a case like this. So when it comes to the oil, what are the chances that Nick is going to be carrying motor oil in his trunk? Probably pretty good, especially since he had an older car where the oil levels might drop quickly, especially back in those days. It's likely he could have been carrying a bottle of oil. It could have been his. But there was also a chance Marcus brought the oil with him, with the intentions of using the cap to jam the throttle open. If he brought the oil, investigators were hoping to prove it. So they obtained another search warrant, this time for Marcus's garage, the likely place one would keep oil. The oil Nick had in his car, there was a lot number printed on the quart. When Marcus's garage was searched, they found a new quart of Valvoline motor oil, and on it was printed the same exact lot number. And there it was. The last piece of this puzzle detectives needed to link Ralph Marcus to the scene of Nick's death. The quarts of oil with the matching lot numbers definitively connected the dots, finally. Ralph Marcus was arrested and charged with Nicholas Howard's murder. Prosecutors floated the theory that over the 20-odd years that Patty Howard had been rebuffing and rejecting his romantic advances, Ralph Marcus grew exponentially more angry. He never let her go, and he never let go of the idea that she should have been with him. But from the day they met, she rejected him at every turn. And by the time they were approaching the period leading up to Nick's death, he began issuing threats towards Patty, telling her things like she deserved to know what it feels like to lose a child, as that he believed could be the only pain comparable to the pain that she had caused him in all those years. So he hatched a plan. He would insert himself into Patty's life through her son. He befriended Nick, and Nick was the only one in his family that would willingly have anything to do with Ralph Marcus. He gained Nick's trust, and eventually, once the time was right, maybe when Nick was out of school, maybe when he turned 18, whatever the case, he would convince Nick to do this harmless, victimless insurance fraud thing. How long Marcus had this plan in his mind is anybody's guess. Could have been from the day Nick was brought into this world. It could have been a thing that percolated in Marcus's tiny little brain over the course of time. Whenever the plan came together, he likely had to wait until Nick was 18 in order for him to be able to sign those legal documents to change the life insurance beneficiary. Nick Howard turned 18 on March 9th, 1996, just 11 months prior to his murder. And once Nick was legally an adult, Ralph Marcus began discussing the plan to fake his death and collect on his life insurance. Then, on the evening of February 5th, 1997, they set their plan in motion. The prosecution believed that Nick and Marcus met near a dock to plan the crash, and they believed either one of two things happened. Either Nick decided he didn't want to go along with the plan anymore, or it was Marcus's intentions to murder Nick and keep all the proceeds from the life insurance for himself. And there are good arguments for both of these theories, but I wouldn't be surprised if Nick wanted to back out. Let's retrace his last known movements and what we know of Nick just before he was murdered. Nick had stopped at that restaurant to pick up his driver's license, and he left a note. I don't know what the note said, however. Did it say he would be back the next day to pick it up? Or did he ask the owner to mail it back to his home address? Either way, if Nick was planning on disappearing following the plan to fake his death on that night, would he really be all that concerned about getting his driver's license back? He wasn't going to be able to show up anywhere to conduct any kind of transactions that would require him to have his ID, because Marcus must have told him that part of faking his death meant going completely off the grid forever. So the fact that Nick was concerned with getting his driver's license back leads me to believe that he was planning to tell Marcus at the docks that he changed his mind and didn't want to disappear from his life. But Marcus was probably salivating over the thought of getting his grubby hands on the $850,000. So for Nick to back out at the last minute was not an option as far as Ralph Marcus was concerned. So he went on to his own plan B, which was to kill Nick, throw him in the water, and then send his car in after him. Also, remember the voicemail Nick left his parents on the answering machine, where he said he was on his way home. He said he was having some car trouble, but he'd be home in about a half hour and that he was wiped out. We could look at this message through two different lenses. The first one has Nick doing what he said he was going to do on the voicemail. He was going to be home. The car trouble was an excuse to buy a little bit of extra time, the time that he would need to stop and tell Marcus that he wasn't going to go through with the faking of his death and that he'd be home in a half hour. Because if Nick was planning on disappearing, why even bother calling and telling his parents why he was running late and when he would be home? It wouldn't have mattered. And it's not like he left an ominous message that one might if they knew that they were not going to see their family anymore for a very long time, possibly forever. Like, he didn't leave a message telling his family that he loved and cared for them. There were no feelings of finality to the message. He intended to back out of the plan and be home that night and every night to come. But the second way we could look at this voicemail was to plant the idea of car trouble in advance of Nick actually having car trouble, namely his car going into the river. He also mentioned how tired he was at the end of the voicemail. This also could have been a way of planting the idea that he was thoroughly exhausted, perhaps even too exhausted to drive safely. And when his car would be found at the bottom of the Sacramento River, his family could point to the message as the reason why Nick lost control of his car and drove it into the river. He fell asleep. His message can be interpreted both ways. One being exactly what he said on the message, and the other to lay the groundwork for the car accident he was on his way to stage. And then there was that carbonless paper copy of the change of beneficiary paper that had crease marks in it that were visible, indicative of someone having crumpled up the document. What this tells me is Nick was having second thoughts about the insurance fraud plan. And when he changed his mind, he crumpled up the application. But at some point, Marcus talked him back into it. So he uncrumpled it and completed the paperwork. And since Nick had changed his mind at least once prior to the night of his death, it isn't a stretch to think that when the moment came to actually go through with it, he got cold feet and changed his mind again. Then there is a theory that it was Marcus's plan all along to kill Nick, and that he kind of seemed prepared to do that. I mean, why split $850,000 when he can have it all to himself? And he could get the retribution that he'd been wanting to get against Nick's mom, make her hurt the way he perceived she spent 20 years hurting him. Also, should Ralph Marcus be caught yet once again and prosecuted for insurance fraud, there would be no witnesses to be granted immunity in exchange for testimony against him. Ralph Marcus had nothing to lose by killing Nick that night and everything to gain. When Nick arrived at the dock, Marcus attacked him, beat him, and strangled him to the point of unconsciousness. Then Marcus took Nick's glasses from him. I don't know if he took them off Nick as he lay unconscious on the ground or if they fell off during the beating. But either way, he took the glasses and bent them way more than he should have to stage an accident where Nick's face would have made contact with the steering wheel had he been in the driver's seat at the time of the crash. Then he callously threw Nick into the river still alive as evident by the water found in Nick's lungs. Then Marcus went to work staging the scene. He cracked open the windows of the car so it would fill with water and sink. He took Nick's broken glasses and planted them on the floorboard to make it appear that Nick had been driving at the time of the accident. He then grabbed a quart of Valvoline motor oil from his own vehicle, took the cap off, tossed the open container of oil into the trunk, and used the cap to rig the throttle. He started the engine, and the car drove itself into the river. Nick's family wouldn't say whether or not Nick was in on the plan to defraud the insurance company, but it seemed pretty clear that he knew what was going on. And it is very sad and very heartbreaking for his family to have the idea of that looming over them. They just knew that Nick understood in order to collect life insurance, he was going to have to be dead. But I do believe that Nick and Marcus were going to have this staged car accident be a nobody ever recovered case. At least that's what Marcus was leading Nick to believe. But knowing what we know about insurance companies, we've seen time and time again that when there is no body or foul play suspected, companies are hesitant to pay out until the investigation into the case has been thoroughly completed. And I'm fairly certain that Ralph Marcus was well aware of this. So it lends to the theory that he planned on killing Nick from the onset. He knew having a body was going to be an important component of collecting on the insurance. If there was no body, how long would Marcus have had to have waited before he would have been able to get his hands on the money? It depends, but it's not that easy and it's not that fast. And I absolutely believe that Ralph Marcus would have rather seen Nick dead than be made to wait any longer than he needed to. Ralph Marcus was tried and convicted of first-degree murder and was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. He is currently housed at Mule Creek State Prison in Ione, California. He is 64 years old. Nick had made some off-the-cuff remarks to his family and friends that he had planned on being a millionaire by the time he was 30 years old. He said that he knew how to disappear in such a way that nobody would ever be able to find him. Comments like these could easily point to Nick having a hand in the fraud, though his family hangs onto the slim chance that it wasn't exactly the case. Nick was a kid, and kids say weird stuff all the time. Who knows, and does it really matter now? Involved or not, it would have all been at the behest of lifelong con man, scumbag, and my new favorite adjective, louse, Ralph Marcus. He had this influence over Nick. He knew how to manipulate him and lure him into this nefarious plan. And I'm with the family on this one. The real evildoer in this story is Ralph Marcus. And just as much as we could fault Nick to an extent for what happened, we also can't believe that Nick, when it came down to the moment of truth, he opted out. He didn't want to go through with it. He didn't want to leave his family. He didn't want them thinking he was dead. He wanted to go home and go to bed. And Ralph Marcus would not allow it. And that, my dreamers, brings this 90th episode of California Dreaming to a close. If you would like to discuss this case in more detail or any others that we have covered, please feel free to request and join the California Dreaming official Facebook discussion page. There, we have cultivated an amazing community of listeners and true crime fans who share their thoughts and opinions on all of our cases that we cover, as well as current true crime stories, other news events, felonies in Florida, felonies right here with Fred, TV shows that we enjoy, documentaries that we've watched, books that we've read, whatever you find that you would like to share, please come and join us. You can follow the show on Twitter at California Pod and on Instagram at California Dreaming Pod. And California Dreaming is proudly brought to you by the Orbital Jigsaw Network. We are a podcast production company located in Los Angeles, California, with a mission to create some of the best podcasts to listen to consistently improve upon our current roster of shows, to develop new content that appeals to people all over the world, and to provide a thriving community for listeners and podcasters alike. I am proud to be a part of this amazing group of shows and talented hosts. So please visit us at www.orbitaljigsaw.com. You can find links to all of our shows, our merchandise store, where you can find California Dreaming merchandise. Get your t-shirt or your mug or your pillow and post it in our group or on Instagram for everybody to see. Or if you just want to email us with your feedback, your comments, your questions, or to just let us know what you think. That's www.orbitaljigsaw.com. Thank you again for listening. I am your host, Roseanne. And until next time, sweet dreams.